Madame Bovary remains one of the most controversial and influential novels in literary history. When it was first published in 1857, Gustave Flaubert was prosecuted for offenses against public morality and religion, a scandal that only heightened the book's notoriety and appeal. The novel has captivated generations of readers and writers alike, with Vladimir Nabokov praising it as prose doing what poetry is supposed to do, and Henry James acknowledging its supreme, unapproachable assurance. Even today, the book continues to resonate with modern audiences, having been adapted numerous times for film and television. Emma Bovary herself has become a cultural archetype, the original desperate housewife whose tragic story of unfulfilled desires and self-destruction speaks to universal human struggles. What makes this provincial tale of adultery and ruin so enduring? Perhaps it's Flaubert's revolutionary narrative technique, his unflinching psychological realism, or his famous declaration, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi," suggesting that Emma's yearnings reflect something fundamental in us all. What makes Flaubert's achievement so remarkable is his transformation of utterly banal subject matter into literary gold. The characters populating his fictional Norman landscape are provincial stereotypes: Emma and Charles trapped in mutual misery, the self-serving pharmacist Homais, the fleshly priest Bournisien, the callous seducer Rodolphe. None displays true decency or depth. Yet through Flaubert's ironic perspective and stylistic precision, this unpromising material becomes extraordinary. His genius lies in elevating mundane provincial life to the realm of high art through meticulous observation and linguistic craftsmanship. The novel's setting mirrors actual Norman landscapes. The modern-day town of Rye claims to be the prototype for Yonville-l'Abbaye, with geographical details meticulously rendered. Flaubert's descriptions capture not just the physical features, but the suffocating atmosphere of provincial life: the dusty roads, the predictable market days, the tedious social rituals. But Flaubert transcends mere realism through subtle adjustments of focus and tone. Consider his famous description of Charles Bovary's cap in the opening scene, ovoid in shape, with three circular sausage-shaped layers. This seemingly simple object becomes strange and significant under Flaubert's gaze, simultaneously devalued and revalorized. The cap serves as both a concrete object and a symbol of Charles's mediocrity, demonstrating Flaubert's ability to infuse ordinary items with deeper meaning. Even in cataloging wedding guests' attire, Flaubert transforms ordinary description into musical exposition. He takes three thematic kernels, dress coats, frock coats, and jackets, and subjects each to elaborate variation. The clothing becomes a social taxonomy, revealing class distinctions and personal pretensions. This technique creates what Henry James called Flaubert's deep vibration beneath apparent realism. Each detail resonates with multiple meanings. A farmer's ill-fitting suit speaks to social aspiration, while a bourgeois gentleman's perfectly pressed coat suggests rigid conformity. The ordinary world becomes extraordinary, not through dramatic events, but through the intensity of observation itself. Flaubert's letters reveal the painstaking labor behind this precision. He spent nearly 5 years writing Madame Bovary, often complaining of slovenly previous work and his attempt to follow a geometrically straight line. He would spend entire weeks crafting single paragraphs, reading them aloud in his famous gloire, shouting room, to test their rhythm and sound. This obsession with style marks a dramatic departure from his earlier, more exuberant works like The Temptation of St. Anthony. The result is a novel that appears effortless while concealing immense artistic discipline, like a swan gliding smoothly while paddling furiously beneath the surface. His revolutionary approach to prose style, with its emphasis on finding le mot juste, the exact right word, would influence generations of writers and establish a new standard for literary realism. Emma Bovary's dreamlike perspective forms the core of Flaubert's narrative technique. Her tendency to gaze into vague distances, following fish vendors' carts along dusty highways, or remembering the mysterious vicomte from the ball, initially appears as creative imagination rather than fatal flaw. She constantly seeks transcendence from the mundane realities of provincial life, having been poisoned by romantic novels during her convent education, where she would spend hours hidden behind pillars devouring contraband literature. At 15, Emma became fascinated with historical romances, idolizing tragic heroines like Mary Queen of Scots and Joan of Arc. She particularly admired their passionate defiance and dramatic destinies, imagining herself in similarly grand narratives. Through music classes and keepsake albums, she absorbed sentimental images of moonlit balconies, Venetian gondoliers, and exotic Mediterranean landscapes. These romantic illusions, nurtured by illustrated magazines and popular songs about distant shores, create impossible expectations for her marriage to the good-hearted but thoroughly ordinary country doctor Charles Bovary, whose conversation never rises above the prosaic details of his medical practice. Flaubert employs free indirect style masterfully to capture Emma's consciousness, a technique revolutionary for its time. This narrative approach allows narrator and character to enter rapturous dialogue, creating a countercurrent of poetic suggestion beneath provincial banality. When Emma contemplates suicide near her window, Flaubert writes, "The ground seemed to sway beneath her feet as she stood at the edge, surrounded by vast space, the buzzing lathe like an angry voice summoning her." We experience her vertigo directly, without the distancing effect of traditional narration, feeling the pull of the void as she does. Emma's tragedy lies in her inability to distinguish between genuine feeling and romantic cliché. After the ball at La Vaubyessarde, she spends hours poring over a map of Paris, tracing routes with her finger and imagining herself in the capital's glamorous salons and opera houses. She memorizes fashion plates and dreams of elaborate toilettes she'll never wear. When her first lover, Rodolphe, abandons her, she falls into religious rapture, buying expensive rosaries and wearing amulets while addressing God with the same caressing words once murmured to her lover. Each new passion, whether religious devotion, motherhood, or adultery, quickly disappoints her when reality fails to match her fantasies, leading her to seek increasingly desperate forms of escape. Yet Flaubert doesn't simply mock Emma's romanticism. Her yearning for something beyond provincial mediocrity reflects his own artistic sensibility and critique of bourgeois society. As he famously declared, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi." Through Emma's tragic imagination, Flaubert explores the universal human desire for transcendence and the painful collision between dreams and reality in a world that offers few outlets for passionate souls trapped in conventional lives. The stifling social environment of Yonville L'Abbaye serves as both setting and antagonist in the novel. This fictional town, described as lying in a bastard region where Normandy, Picardy, and Île-de-France meet, perfectly embodies the cultural and intellectual limitations that suffocate Emma. The landscape divides neatly between grazing land and plow fields, with the plain unfurling golden wheat fields eastward, a symmetrical blandness that mirrors the town's rigid social structure. The town's architecture further reinforces this sense of confinement, with its narrow streets, identical shuttered houses, and the oppressive church spire that dominates the skyline, constantly reminding inhabitants of their moral obligations. Marriage itself becomes the primary instrument of Emma's confinement. Her wedding to Charles initially promises escape from her father's farm, but quickly becomes another form of imprisonment. Charles's contentment with domestic mediocrity, his delight in small pleasures like evening meals by the fire, his satisfaction with routine medical visits, and his morning intimacies only intensifies Emma's sense of suffocation. She finds herself never for a moment suspecting that what had once been happiness might now be torture. The daily rituals of married life, the predictable meals, the mundane conversations, the provincial social calls become increasingly unbearable for Emma, who yearns for the passionate existence she has read about in novels. The novel's secondary characters vividly embody various aspects of provincial conformity. Homais, the pharmacist, represents pseudo-intellectual pomposity, constantly spouting scientific terminology and writing florid newspaper articles while bullying his apprentice Justin. His endless tirades against superstition mask a deep intellectual insecurity, and his social climbing reveals the hollow ambitions of provincial society. The priest Bournisien exemplifies religious complacency, completely misunderstanding Emma's spiritual crisis when she seeks his counsel, offering platitudes instead of genuine spiritual guidance. His inability to comprehend emotional complexity reflects the church's failure to address real human suffering. Even Emma's lovers ultimately disappoint her. Leon, growing conventional in his legal career, adopting the very bourgeois values he once scorned, while Rodolphe proves cynically calculating in his seduction, treating romance as a game he has mastered through repetition. Women's limited options form a particular focus of Flaubert's social critique. Emma's education at the convent has prepared her only for romantic fantasies, not practical life, teaching her to dream of love but nothing of financial management or personal autonomy. Her attempts at self-improvement through reading and music lack direction and support, becoming mere distractions rather than paths to genuine growth. When financial disaster strikes, her desperate attempts to secure money, running from merchant to moneylender to former lover, reveal her complete powerlessness in a male-dominated economic system. The notary Guillaumin's proposition, offering financial help in exchange for sexual favors, starkly illustrates women's commodification in this society, where even educated professional men view them primarily as objects for transaction. Perhaps most devastating is the fate of Emma's daughter, Berthe. After both parents die, she is sent to work in a cotton mill, a grim reminder that the cycle of limited opportunities for women continues into the next generation. Her descent from middle-class comfort to industrial labor represents the precariousness of women's social position and the failure of progress to reach provincial France. Meanwhile, the novel's final irony shows Homais receiving the Legion of Honor, confirming that mediocrity and conformity ultimately triumph in this social order. His success, achieved through persistent self-promotion and adherence to conventional wisdom, stands as a bitter commentary on a society that rewards appearance over substance and conformity over authentic living. Emma's downfall follows a trajectory of escalating consumption and debt that parallels her emotional and sexual appetites. After her disillusionment with marriage, she begins transforming the Bovary household, removing candlestick shades, hanging new wallpaper, repainting stairs, and adding garden benches. These purchases represent her attempt to create external beauty when inner fulfillment eludes her. The merchant Leroux becomes a sinister enabler of Emma's material desires. He first appears carrying fabric samples and offering his services with obsequious charm. His name itself suggests both the happy one, Leroux, and the usurer, Lucier, reflecting his dual role as provider of pleasures and financial predator. He systematically entangles Emma in a web of credit, promissory notes, and compound interest that eventually proves inescapable. As Emma's affairs progress, her spending accelerates. For Rodolphe, she purchases a riding habit, embroidered slippers, and a silver-topped riding crop. For Leon, she buys yellow curtains and plans a carpet. Each purchase represents not just material acquisition, but an attempt to construct a more romantic identity. When Emma visits Rouen for her trysts with Leon, she stays at the Hotel de Boulogne, surrounded by flowers and chilled fruit cordials, creating a fantasy world funded entirely by debt. Flaubert's detailed accounting of Emma's financial collapse reveals his understanding of 19th-century consumer capitalism. We learn the exact amounts of her debts: promissory notes for 250 francs each, a total obligation of 8,000 francs, and the precise sum remaining after Charles sells everything, 12 francs 75 centimes. This precision contrasts sharply with Emma's financial ignorance and magical thinking about money. The inventory of Emma's possessions before the bailiff's sale poignantly catalogs the material remnants of her dreams: a dress with a gold braided collar, a cashmere shawl, a beaver muff, and four novels bound in gilt-edged Morocco. These objects, once symbols of refinement and escape, become mere items on a liquidation list. Emma's body itself becomes a commodity when she attempts to trade sexual favors for financial salvation, first with the notary Guillaumin, who propositions her directly, and then with Rodolphe, whom she approaches, never for a moment suspecting that she was about to prostitute herself. This economic narrative culminates in Emma's desperate consumption of arsenic, her final, fatal purchase that transforms her from consumer to consumed. Flaubert's reputation as the first modern novelist rests largely on his revolutionary narrative technique. Rather than directly stating characters' emotions or motivations, he reveals them through carefully chosen physical details, symbolic patterns, and the famous free indirect style that blends narrators' and characters' perspectives. Consider how Flaubert conveys Emma's emotional state after the ball at La Vaubyessard. Rather than telling us she feels disappointed with her ordinary life, he shows her dusting her collection of miniature views of Switzerland and placing them in a different spot, a small action that speaks volumes about her restlessness and desire for change. When she burns her wedding bouquet, we witness the orange blossoms and silver ribbons consume themselves like black butterflies flying up the chimney, a powerful image of her marriage's destruction without explicit commentary. Flaubert's predilection for triadic structures, assonance, and resonance creates a sensory architecture where even agriculture becomes musicalized. The recurring motifs of vibration, distance, and fading sound underscore Emma's mortality. Of all the world's sounds, Emma heard only the intermittent sobbing of that poor man, soft and faint, like the fading echo of an ever more distant symphony. Perhaps most innovative is Flaubert's use of significant absences and ellipses. The novel's most intimate scenes often occur off-page, with Flaubert focusing instead on peripheral details. When Emma and Rodolphe consummate their affair, we see only water lilies on the pond, and Emma afterward examining herself in the mirror, astonished at her unfathomable eyes. Similarly, Emma's infamous carriage ride with Leon through the streets of Rouen, one of literature's first sex scenes, describes only the exterior of the moving vehicle with drawn blinds. This technique of indirection extends to dialogue as well. Characters frequently talk past each other, revealing their isolation. When Emma attempts to confess her spiritual suffering to the priest Bornesian, he completely misunderstands, thinking she means physical hunger. Their conversation becomes a study in mutual incomprehension. "But what exactly is troubling you? What's the matter?" "I suffer," said Emma. "Well, so do I," replied the priest. "It's hardly surprising with this heat." This failure of communication recurs throughout the novel, emphasizing the character's fundamental loneliness despite their physical proximity. Poison serves as both literal cause of Emma's death and extended metaphor throughout the novel. From her convent days, Emma has been poisoned by romantic novels that create impossible expectations. Her dissatisfaction spreads like a toxin through her relationships, corrupting her marriage, motherhood, and eventually her lovers. The pharmacy becomes a central symbolic location, with Homais's red and green jars casting colored light across the pavement and fetuses floating in murky alcohol. His Capernaum storeroom houses dangerous substances that Justin will eventually provide to Emma. Even before her suicide, Emma experiments with self-medication, drinking vinegar to lose weight, and developing a cough that foreshadows her final illness. Flaubert's medical background, his father was a distinguished surgeon, informs his clinical description of Emma's poisoning. The progression follows actual arsenic symptoms with horrifying precision. Her blue-tinged face drips with sweat, her teeth chatter, she experiences violent convulsions, and her body deteriorates visibly. The priest administers last rites, anointing her eyes, which had so fiercely craved every earthly luxury, her pleasure-seeking nostrils, her lying mouth, her sensation-hungry hands, and her feet, once so swift in speeding her to satisfy her desire. This methodical cataloging of body parts transforms the religious ritual into a final accounting of Emma's sensual existence. Her death scene intertwines spiritual and physical elements as she kisses the crucifix passionately, experiencing a moment of religious ecstasy. A blind beggar song drifts up from below, causing her to rear up with a ghastly laugh before collapsing. The blind beggar himself functions as a memento mori throughout the novel. With his reddened eyelids and bluish flesh, cracked with old scabs, he represents physical corruption and mortality. His grotesque appearance and lewd song about a young girl's love create an ironic counterpoint to Emma's romantic illusions. When he appears during her death scene, the juxtaposition completes Flaubert's unsparing portrait of human mortality. After death, Emma's body undergoes final transformations. Charles insists on burying her in her wedding dress with white shoes and a wreath, demanding three coffins and green velvet covering, a grotesque parody of romantic imagery. As earth falls on her coffin with that terrifying drumming that resounds in our ears like the voice of eternity, we witness the final dissolution of her physical being. The novel's final chapter traces the ripple effects of Emma's death on those who loved or exploited her. Charles's grief deepens as he struggles to comprehend the reality of this nothingness. He keeps Berthe close, explaining her mother has gone away to bring toys. Financial troubles mount as Leroux pressures him with exorbitant debts, while Charles refuses to sell any of Emma's possessions. When Charles discovers evidence of Emma's affairs, his jealousy dissolves into immense pain as he concludes that everyone must have adored her. He adopts her tastes and habits, keeping her bedroom untouched. His encounter with Rodolphe at a market in Argueil reveals his complete emotional collapse. After initial tension, they share a beer, and Charles gazes at this face Emma once loved, feeling he's seeing part of her again. His memorable phrase, "fate is to blame," encapsulates his inability to judge or condemn Emma despite her betrayal. The next day, Charles is found dead in the garden arbor, clutching a lock of black hair. The autopsy reveals nothing, suggesting he died of grief rather than physical causes. Everything is sold, leaving 12 francs 75 centimes to send Berthe to her grandmother, who dies that same year. With Emma's father paralyzed by stroke, Berthe goes to an aunt who sends her to work in a cotton mill, a grim conclusion that suggests Emma's romantic rebellion has ultimately failed to change the social order. Meanwhile, Emma's lovers move on with minimal consequences. Leon eventually marries a notary's daughter and settles into conventional bourgeois life. Rodolphe, who triggered Emma's first major crisis by abandoning her, continues his comfortable existence at La Huchette, apparently untroubled by conscience. The novel's final irony shows Homé prospering, having ruined three doctors' attempts to establish practices in Yonville. He has just been awarded the Legion of Honor, confirming that mediocrity and self-promotion triumph while genuine passion leads to destruction. This conclusion completes Flaubert's unsparing portrait of provincial society, where conformity is rewarded and deviation punished. Yet despite this bleak ending, Emma Bovary herself achieves a kind of immortality through Flaubert's art. Her yearnings and sufferings, rendered with unprecedented psychological depth, continue to resonate with readers across cultures and centuries. As Flaubert himself declared, "Madame Bovary, c'est moi," suggesting that her desires, however misguided, reflect something universal in the human condition. Madame Bovary marks a decisive turning point in European fiction, establishing a new standard for psychological realism that influenced generations of writers. Flaubert's microscopic attention to physical detail, his precise rendering of consciousness, and his refusal of easy moral judgments created a template for the modern novel. Yet Flaubert's achievement transcends simple realism. His self-reflexive quality makes him distinctively modern, extending beyond mimetic representation to join the tradition of Cervantes and Sterne. By acknowledging the vulnerability of writers facing language's arbitrariness, human language is like a cracked kettle on which we beat out tunes for bears to dance to when what we long to do is make music that will move the stars to pity. Flaubert anticipates modernist concerns with the limitations of representation itself. The novel's influence extends beyond literature into psychology and philosophy. Emma Bovary's condition gave rise to the term Bovarism, defined as the human tendency to conceive of oneself as other than one is, a concept that anticipates Freudian theories of fantasy and desire. Her dissatisfaction with ordinary life and yearning for transcendent experience speaks to existential questions that would preoccupy thinkers from Kierkegaard to Sartre. Flaubert's artistic process itself became legendary. His agonizing 5-year struggle to perfect Madame Bovary established a model of the writer as craftsman rather than inspired genius. His famous search for le mot juste, the perfect word, and his practice of reading his work aloud to test its prose rhythm influenced writers from Joyce to Nabokov to Hemingway. Perhaps most remarkably, Madame Bovary remains accessible and emotionally powerful despite its formal sophistication. Emma's dreams and disappointments, her passionate embraces and desperate schemes, her moments of exaltation and despair all feel immediately recognizable to contemporary readers. Her tragedy transcends its specific 19th-century context to become a universal story of human longing and limitation. When we close the novel, we're left with indelible images. Emma watching fish vendors' carts disappear along distant highways, her face illuminated by firelight at the Lion d'Or, her hand in Rodolphe's as prize announcements interrupt their intimate conversation, her blue-tinged face in death. Through Flaubert's art, this provincial doctor's wife achieves the immortality that eluded her in life, remembered not for her sins or virtues, but for the intensity of her desires and the depth of her disillusionment.